Okay, my name is Molly Marin. I'm the RTI webinar coordinator for the New York State RTI Technical Assistance Center. Just a few reminders before we get started today. A copy of our PowerPoint presentation for today is available on our webpage if you want to grab that and follow along. You're welcome to do so. At the end of today's webinar, I will post a link to an evaluation. That also comes to everyone via email. And if you could please take a few minutes to complete that, we would very much appreciate it. We do look at that every week. Also, during the webinar, please use the chat box to ask any questions or provide any comments that you have. We will be looking at that throughout the webinar. Today is our third webinar in the RTI Implementation in the Middle School series. Next week, we have Tier 2 intervention in an RTI middle school. More information and registration information can be found on our webpage. We hope you'll come back and join us next week for that. And today's topic is on scheduling RTI in the middle school. We're very pleased to have Dr. Evelyn Johnson back with us again today. Dr. Johnson is a professor of special education at Boise State University and the executive director of the Lee Pesky Learning Center, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to improve the lives of people with learning disabilities. Dr. Johnson is a screening tool review committee member for the National Center for Response to Intervention and co-author of three books, all published by Corwin Press, Identification and Evaluation of Learning Disabilities, How RTI Works in Secondary Schools, and RTI, A Practitioner's Guide to Implementation. Welcome, Dr. Johnson.
Thanks, Molly, and hello to everybody today. And for those of you who are returning, welcome back, and thanks for coming back. Like Molly said, we are on the third of a series of five webinars, all designed to address RTI implementation at middle school. Last week, we went into a lot of detail about different assessment tools, primarily screening and progress monitoring tools. And this week, we're going to shift our focus somewhat to look at how schools can organize their schedules and their processes so that they are designed to implement RTI well. I always like to remind us what we're trying to accomplish in implementing an RTI system. I think it's really important to come back to what the purpose is, because we don't want logistics to drive implementation, right? We want purpose to drive, and then our question becomes, what do I need? What resources do I need? What infrastructure do I need in order to accomplish this goal? Okay, so our purpose of RTI is going to vary depending on your school and your context, but in our very first session, most of you indicated that you were using RTI for these two stated purposes. We're both trying to prevent kids who are at risk for poor school outcomes from experiencing those, and we're trying to intervene in a way that allows us to have a fluid and responsive instructional system for our struggling learners. Okay? So the question about today is, how can we organize our school, our calendar? What scheduling considerations do we have to really pay attention to and be mindful of? And how can we do it in a way that's going to allow us to accomplish these purposes? Okay, so rather than clutter up slides with citations all throughout, I thought it would just be more helpful to give you a list of the different resources that inform today's presentation. So that first link takes you to the National RTI Center. There is a specific area on that webpage devoted to both middle school and high school RTI implementation. For when that center was in existence, there was a strong focus on middle school implementation models, and there are a number of what I think are really practitioner-friendly publications that can walk school teams through these questions about scheduling and logistics. Several years ago, I had the opportunity to be involved in the national RTI middle school evaluation study, and I worked with Lori Smith, who is the principal at Cheyenne Mountain Junior High in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and her school served as one of our first middle school sites that we used as a sort of a case test to figure out, you know, all of the questions that we talked about in the first webinar session together. What does RTI implementation look like? How do you solve these questions about implementation and logistics? And so in the text that we co-authored, she has included a lot of practical examples and information from the leadership perspective on, you know, to state really clearly how she went about addressing some of the questions that we're going to talk about today. We'll also take a look at some of the checklists and tools that are available online through the RTI Action Network. So that resource is provided by the National Center on Learning Disabilities. Several years ago, they received generous funding from two foundations to create the RTI Action Network, and drawing on experts from across the nation, they put together a really nice host, or nice suite, I guess, of different publications and resources that focus on various aspects of RTI implementation. We'll take a look at some of the work from Joe Kovaleski out of Pennsylvania. And then what was interesting, I was talking with Molly before we started today. I like to make sure that I'm very current on middle school resources. And so your own state RTI Technical Assistance Center has actually referenced a lot of the resources that I use today, and they're all available and packaged for you on their website under the middle school category. So you have several different places that you can draw some helpful resources from in addition to the conversation we'll have here today. And I can't remember if we said this, but, you know, as we go along, especially since there's a slightly smaller group than what we said, if you have questions, please feel free to ask them in the chat box as we go along. And last time, before we ended, we had a couple questions, and I've integrated responses to those questions in today's presentation. But if you feel like I still haven't answered it at the end, we should have some time at the end to make sure that I've addressed everybody's concerns to the extent that I can. So in thinking about how to structure today's talk, you know, rather than get immediately like into the weeds about how do I schedule this, how do I find time for this, what model should I use, I really thought it would be more helpful if we looked at scheduling considerations through somewhat of a framework, right? And that framework is, what are the things that I'm going to need, what are the structures that I'm going to need to have in place in order to implement RTI that currently don't exist in my school, right? And so when I sat down and thought about what those things are, I think one very important consideration is to have a team of folks who are charged with ensuring that RTI implementation happens, right? So we need time for that group of people, whether we call it RTI leadership team or a PLC, you know, however your school is going to refer to it. We need time to get that group together to make sure that they can review data, review action plans, and so on. We also need to think about an assessment schedule. So last week we talked about the requirements for universal screening. We talked about the need for diagnostic assessments, for progress monitoring at the various tiers of intervention. All of those things really need to become part of the school calendar because, like anything, if it's something that we should do but we don't actually make time for it, it can easily get pushed aside, and then we're either, you know, scrambling to get caught up or we don't have sufficient data to drive our instructional decision making. We also have to use that then to really think about, okay, what is our data telling us about the needs of our students? So last week when I said, you know, what questions do you have for this week's topic, a couple people asked, well, what's better? Is a push-in model better? Is a pull-out model better? And I give the answer that I so often give. It really depends on what your data is telling you. So we'll take a look today at how we can use our data to consider the needs of our students and how we should let that data, again, let that data drive the decision-making regarding the schedule rather than have the schedule drive the decision-making on how we're going to meet the needs. Okay, it's an easy sentence to say on a webinar. It's a pretty significant paradigm shift at the secondary level. Okay? We also want to think about ways that we can restructure the current class schedule. In our work out, this is actually true across the grade level spectrum, so elementary, middle, and high school. We're asked, you know, how can I free up any time during the day? Every minute is jam-packed. And when we go through and we look at schedules and we consider what are the priorities in terms of reading goals or math goals, and how can we let go of some things that are nice to have, but they don't help support our stated academic goals, and how can we then reclaim some time in the day to make sure we're providing good intervention. We haven't been stumped yet. We've always been able to find time to at least get started with intervention. Related to both of those areas, we want to think about what's the frequency and length of those classes, and then finally, who is going to provide that intervention, right? Because as all of you know, not only do we have to find schedules and slot our students, but then if we are doing things like reducing teacher-student ratio and drawing on expertise that very few teachers in our building might have, we have to be a lot more mindful about how we're structuring our teacher time as well. Okay, so those are the things that we're going to talk about in more detail today. So if we start with the RTI leadership team, probably lots of you have something like this in place. And in general, the purpose is to manage the implementation of the RTI process. And so some of the considerations in regard to scheduling are, first of all, you know, before the school year starts, we want this team to have some dedicated time to collaborate and identify priorities, identify goals, identify strategies for accomplishing those goals, and then also having the time for setting the rest of the yearly calendar for things like, when are we going to meet? Do we need to meet on a weekly basis? Is every other week sufficient? Who is going to represent, who is going to be represented on this team? Do we need someone from every grade? Do we need our special ed teacher? Do we need our title teacher if we have that? Who from administration is going to be present? And how does that factor into our scheduling? And then as we move into the year, you're not going to have a lot of time to meet, right? So in most of the schools that we've worked in, these meetings are usually scheduled for about an hour, and we find that the meetings are most productive when teams, after they get through those kind of big questions like what are our goals, and when they don't have the sessions where they're having to review benchmark data and they're just sort of checking in on action items, when we use a standard agenda format for every meeting and we really adhere to that agenda, then those weekly or every other week meetings can become really, really efficient. And I thought it might be helpful if I could just show one. Molly, can you? Thank you. So hopefully you all can see just a tier one team meeting agenda. And we actually use this both in a middle school and an elementary school that where we had a two-year-long project on a combined RTI-PBIS implementation project here in Idaho. And we just had, we're going to review the agenda, so this is what we're going to do. And then we had a place where we had a task list of who was going to review the task list, what was the task, what was the deadline, and then an update on status. And then we moved into a review of existing data on both academic outcomes and referral data, if and only if we've collected new information since the prior meeting. We also, because it was combined academic and PBIS, we also looked at behavior outcomes and referral data. And we looked at the fidelity tools that are used in the PBIS model, so the team implementation checklist and the others that are listed here. So we would review those data points as needed and as relevant. And then we would discuss any issues based on those data that surface. So, for example, when we would look at benchmark data, and one of the things that we identified when we were working with the middle school is that the sixth graders were coming in at extremely low levels in reading, so something, you know, something approaching 50% of their incoming sixth graders were not meeting their literacy targets. And so, you know, that's not a problem we're going to handle through providing tier two intervention. Instead, the action item then became to coordinate with the feeder elementary schools to find out what was, you know, why the shift, what was happening between that fifth and sixth grade year. And then we'd move on to the action planning and task list so that everybody would leave the meeting. And again, where relevant and appropriate, they would leave with a task and a timeline for having some, you know, resolution or next step towards that task. And it sounds very rigid, and in truth it was, and it took us a really long time to get the team to maintain that level of efficiency. But once we did, it really helped the team stay focused and move through their meeting time with a purpose, right? Because 1 hour in our school day, it sounds like such a gift to get to collaborate, but it also can be squandered really easily. And so an agenda, whether it's this format or another format, just really helps keep the team focused and on task. Okay. And I'm going to go back to the slides. Okay. Okay. Over time, oh, so Joy is asking, where can we get a copy of this agenda? I will email a link to Molly. It's available on our state's Idaho's training clearinghouse. And so I'll email the link to Molly when we're done here today. Once the leadership team really kind of gets into their groove, so to speak, it's really important not only to stick to an efficient process, but to really determine whether the schedule is needed and whether the meeting time is effective. And so the National Center for RTI put together just some guiding questions to evaluate implementation, and those include the things that are listed here, right? So is this leadership team meeting time, is it working? Do most people attend, right? Or does it seem like every week someone's missing because of parent meeting or because of getting ready for class or because they can't, we decided to schedule it before school and they just can't get here early enough, right? So those kinds of questions. are we really using the time as it's designed? And again, that's where the agenda becomes really helpful. And it also serves as a really nice ongoing record so that as you have turnover in who constitutes that leadership team, you have a nice historical record and documentation of the process to date. Okay. Are we actually accomplishing anything, or are we meeting just because someone said we needed an RTI leadership team and we're meeting? Okay. So those are important things to ask because, again, time in every survey and every conversation that we have with schools and districts about, you know, what are your greatest obstacles pretty much to everything, it's always that lack of time. So when we carve out time to make, you know, for important things, we want to make sure we're using it effectively. Okay. The next consideration is how are we going to make sure that we collect the assessment data that helps drive all of our intervention decisions? And so, just like anything, we want to make sure we calendar dates when this is going to happen, and we want to do it at the beginning of the year, just like we would schedule fire drills and, you know, any other school event. So we want to make sure that we have, if we're moving to a three times a year for screening, we want to make sure that that's scheduled. If we're using a fall and winter screening model only, we want to make sure that those are scheduled. We want to make sure that not only do we have one day for screening, but that we also have one or two days for catching students who are absent. And then we also want to allow time for that follow-up diagnostic of the kids who we identified as at risk on our screening tool. Okay. For progress monitoring, you know, most schools are pretty good about scheduling screening time. What they forget to do then is schedule the progress monitoring time. Like we've met with so many secondary teams who say, well, I'm going to try and progress monitor all my kids on Fridays, right? Well, so the analogy I always use is, you know, I love to run, so I don't need to schedule running. But as I get older, I need to lift weights to avoid injury. I hate lifting weights, but I know I have to do it. If I don't actually put it in my calendar, even though I tell myself I'm going to go on, you know, Tuesday and Thursday morning or whatever before or after my run, I'm going to do it. If I don't put it on my calendar, I don't do it. So progress monitoring, put it on your calendar. And last week we talked about progress monitoring across the tiers. So that means we want to make sure that we schedule time for those efforts. So in tier one, we may only progress monitor, you know, once during the marking period, right? But we want to schedule when we're going to administer common assessments or end of course exams. In tier two, we want to set either a weekly or a biweekly progress monitoring schedule so that we know this class period is when I am collecting my CBM data for my kids who are in intervention. And then for our tier three kids, we probably want to progress monitor, and I'm using tier three synonymously with special education, we probably want to progress monitor weekly. Okay. Not only do we want to schedule the time to collect data, but we want to schedule the time to analyze and review data. And this is where most of our teams really needed that extra coaching, I think, in making sure that they allowed for that time. So with so many schools that we started with, they would get through the collection phase, and that's an important first step, right? But then we would get to the meeting where we were supposed to be reviewing results, and nobody had taken the time to aggregate and put results into a format that were really usable within that 1 hour review time. Okay, so we want to make sure that we assign the task of aggregating the data and analyzing and reviewing the data, and we want to put that on the calendar with a specific point person, right? And what we're trying to do through that analysis is we're trying to prioritize our data and determine what our intervention needs might be based on our screening and diagnostic result. Okay? Same with progress monitoring data review. It's important first step is to get into the habit of collecting that progress monitoring data, but then we also need to devote the time to get together and review our progress monitoring results. And so the way that we worked with both middle and high school here, where they were really interested in getting a stronger tier two and three system, is we didn't have the progress monitoring data review happen every week, because at the secondary level, oftentimes the growth that we see at those grade levels is actually not as pronounced as it is in the elementary level. And so you want to have some time to collect more data points so that you get a more reliable graph of your student's progress, right? So we scheduled a monthly progress monitoring data review, even though they were collecting data every week. Okay. Hopefully that makes sense. And again, if not, then please feel free to ask questions in the chat box. Okay. So for our screening review data, we can make fancy meeting agenda templates like the one that I showed you, or we can simply have a standing agenda of a bulleted list of these are things that we're going to look at, right? So again, when we're reviewing screening data, someone's going to bring the aggregated results to our meeting. And by aggregated, we want by grade level, by content area, who is meeting benchmark and which kids are not meeting benchmark. And for that at-risk pool, if you remember our screening process that we looked at last week, we want to look at both kids who are, slightly below benchmark and those kids who are really below benchmark, right, or who have a large discrepancy. Because we're probably going to have different intervention needs for those two groups. Right? And then we want to also know how many of our students need further diagnostic information, and then have a solid plan for how and who is going to collect that diagnostic information. So Laura's asking if we'll address the types of screeners that are being used. Laura, I don't know if you were online with us last week, but last week's session we went into depth on a number of different tools and resources that are available. So this week we're going to focus more on the schedule and because the assessment tool decision is really school or district based, we're going to talk about it in more of a general sense. So we'll do that initial screening review, but then we'll also look at our diagnostic results. And again, we'll want to have a process for how we review diagnostic results. And so we want someone to bring our aggregated results to our meeting that we have after we look at after we conduct the diagnostics. And here, by aggregated results, what we want to do is, as much as our screening tools, again, depending on what they are, allow us to do that, we want to think about where the specific need within reading. So we don't want to stop at just, 18% of our kids are below benchmark in reading, right? We don't want to stop there. What we'd love to be able to do is have a finer grain analysis through our diagnostic information. So does it seem like we still have a number of kids who need decoding help? Most often, that's where the problem lies, right? Even at middle school, we think we're done teaching kids how to decode, but it's been our experience all the way through high school that when we are able to sit with a student and sort of work backwards to identify where their skill breakdown is, It's on either not having a strong enough knowledge of the code or not being fluent in applying their decoding skills to unknown words, okay? And so the reason why we want to do that is because we want to get a sense of how to prioritize and structure our intervention, okay? When we work with schools, RTI is very complex, right? And so a lot of the schools that we work with, they do a fabulous job in wanting to get started, right? And so they look at what the components of an RTI model are, and they adopt screening tools, and then they have an intervention, and they say, well, we're going to use, for example, language explanation point as an intervention. And now I'm not trying to criticize or discredit language, but what I am criticizing is that it's RTI is not simply a string of separate components, and as long as I have each component in place, then I have an RTI system. Rather, all of the decisions about what our intervention looks like and what tools we're going to use for intervention really should come from a careful analysis and evaluation of our data, okay? So language may very well be the right program for a Tier 2 intervention for lots of schools, but without really being thorough about trying to identify where are most of my kids experiencing a breakdown in reading or in math or in writing, oftentimes we can get an intervention in place and we can, you know, assure ourselves we have an RTI model, but really all we've done is set up yet another class that's really not being responsive to student needs, okay? So our goal in this process, and the reason why it's so important to dedicate the time and to schedule the time and the review time for looking at diagnostics is because it should drive everything else that happens in your RTI system. Okay. When we look at progress monitoring results, it's the same thing, right? So our agenda can be really straightforward. Someone brings aggregated results to the meeting, and then we just do a quick review of here are the number of kids who are receiving Tier 2 intervention. Of that number of kids, here are the number of kids who are on track. They're meeting their goals, right? Their progress looks good. Here are the number of kids who have met and exceeded and sustained their goals and are ready to exit Tier 2, right? And then we want to take a look at who those kids are and spend the time at that meeting developing a plan for their support. And then the other group of kids we want to look at are what are the number of kids who may need instructional change, and let's ensure that these instructional changes are discussed with a plan for implementation. So, Molly, if I can share my screen, I'm going to go back to show. Thank you. Last week, I showed you a tool called CBM Focus, and I'm going to pull it up again because I want to show you how simple this standing agenda is. So, this is data that we used at a secondary school, and literally once we got through, here are the number of kids who are not meeting their progress monitoring goals, we would then take a look at, once we got through, here are the number of kids who are on track to meeting their progress monitoring goals, then we spent the next part of our progress monitoring review looking at the kids who are not meeting their goals. So here's Alec. So you can see that he is flatlining. He's not incredibly below his reading goal, but he doesn't seem to be making any progress towards becoming more fluent. And so by this point, we had a very stable trend line for him. And what we decided to do was have someone with a lot more in-depth reading knowledge. So we got a reading specialist from the elementary school to come up to the, in this case, this was a high school, to come up to the high school and sit down with Alec to really review his oral reading fluency and determined that he had basic decoding skills, his multisyllabic. He had no strategy for breaking down multisyllabic words, and if they were too long, applying just standard decoding skills took him too long. So he's just never getting more fluent when approaching an unknown word. So we ended up changing his intervention program to include more of a focus on the use of rewards, right? And rewards is a, I'm sure lots of you know it, but it's the Anita Archer program that's designed for secondary students. And so we would just go through and we would talk about Dion. Dion's time for, he's making progress, but we'd like to see that rate of progress slightly higher because at the rate he's at, he's still going to be, you know, wildly discrepant at the end of the year. So same process, right? So by having the data organized in this fashion, we didn't need to create multiple systems to structure our meeting times. We had the data right here through this CBM focus. It did it for us, and then we could just quickly scroll through the graphs and review the kids that we needed to make those instructional decisions for. All right, and so I stopped sharing. Thanks. Okay. One of the things that we found during those meeting times when we would first get started is, I know I'm going a little bit beyond scheduling considerations here, but it was really hard to look at that data, especially at the secondary level, and not say, well, yeah, that's Alec or that's Dion. Of course, that's his graph, and say, and then move on, or not to have teachers say things like he's not motivated, and you know those kinds of things. Of course, we would look at things like were they coming to class, right? But that's different than saying, well, he's not trying, and when we do the assessment, he doesn't care, and so. One of the things, you know, we started with the schedule and the structure first, right, because we have to have that in place. And then over time, what we really tried to do was change the orientation and the nature of the dialogue during those assessment review meetings. And it wasn't just at the secondary level. This used to happen at the two-year project we did at both elementary and middle school. A common issue was, you know, a child who was really struggling, who had that flat line or really little progress on their progress monitoring graph, a very common reaction was, oh, well, he's in the elementary school, the special ed teacher's name was also Johnson. So it's like, oh, that's Mrs. Johnson's student. Of course, he's not making growth. And it's like, wait a minute, like that is not the conversation to have. At the high school that we worked in, the teachers really, the meetings were interesting because it was this wonderful dynamic group of teachers. But then we would get into that progress monitoring meeting, and all of a sudden, it was like you could cut the air with a knife because they were all so tense, because the vice principal also attended those meetings. And here they were putting up progress of their students and having to talk about, you know, essentially, how can I do better in meeting the needs of the student? And they were very uncomfortable initially with that conversation because, you know, to them, the perception was, I am not doing a good job as the teacher. And so we really had to work hard to establish that climate of trust and really reassure our teachers and the staff that the goal is to make sure that our students are doing as well as possible, right? The goal isn't to, you know, hunt down and root out terrible teachers. It's to really make sure we are doing a good job helping all of our students make progress. And so, you know, we were there as project staff. It was a project funded through our state, but for teams who don't have that, there's a really great tool that was developed by Joe Kovaleski, and there's the link to it. And Molly, if I can just pull up, this is the last time I'm going to screen share. I'll pull up what this looks like for you. Right. So this is a script that Joe Kovaleski and his colleagues put together that really just help facilitate that data review and instructional planning session. And so you'll see that they describe what the procedures are in this first column, and then he's just provided some prompts for how to guide the conversation and how to move the conversation forward. So, you know, if you see, I'm pointing at my screen like you can see where I'm pointing, sorry. So if you see some of the typical prompts from the facilitator are things like, let's analyze how our students are doing on, okay? And so the idea is that we're really focused on student growth and student performance. And then we're setting goals. And the other thing I think that's important, and if you download this document and review it, throughout the prompts are always in a collective perspective. So it's always, what can we do? How are our students doing? Let's look at this data. What does this mean? And so the focus is never on, Mrs. Johnson, how many of your students are making growth in your class? And those are really important small considerations, again, that all go towards establishing that climate of trust and feeling safe to look at data that sometimes isn't telling us what we really want to hear. Okay, so I think that's the last time I'm going to screen share. Okay. So the main takeaway here for assessment is, let's make sure that we schedule time for collection, time for aggregate, at least for, you know, one or two people to aggregate results in a format that's usable, and then let's schedule time to really evaluate those results. So let's spend time looking at the data, and we need to schedule those things, okay? From that process, then we need to determine what our student needs are. And again, like I mentioned in the beginning, in an ideal scenario, we want student need to drive how we are structuring our intervention system. Now, I know that is incredibly idealistic, but it has been our experience, and Lori Smith, who I talked about at the beginning in Colorado Springs, was a great example of this. They got started with a tier two intervention, and because it was such a huge process for them to take on, they created an intervention period within their existing school structure that they called Literacy Lab. And they said, okay, kids who are not meeting reading benchmarks, go to Literacy Lab, right? And so they worked within their existing structure to begin implementation. Over time, what they found was that the Literacy Lab for some of their kids just wasn't sufficient, right? So by having that one-size-fits-all class, it was a great way for them to get started. But what they found as they continued to look at their data was that for kids who were like just below benchmark, it helped them make progress in reading. That progress didn't always transfer into better support in their content area classes. And then for kids who are really struggling, the Literacy Lab wasn't intensive enough to meet their needs, right? So again, it was like sort of phase one. And then when they really, once they got that system established, then they got, you know, they became more savvy about looking at their data, and then they were able to get more creative about how to design their schedule and intervention period so that they could better meet the needs. And she'll be the first to tell you that it's still not ideal, but that they do really work towards trying to make the assessment drive those decisions rather than here's our model. If you fit, great. If you don't, I'm sorry, it's the best I can do. Okay. So the questions that I have listed here are just examples of things that should be asked and discussed when planning for intervention. So what's the concern? What's the area of the specific area of need? What's the severity of it? What supports do we need? If I have lots of kids who are slightly below benchmark, I might think of more of a push-in model for them. If for my kids who are more intense, I might want to have more of a pull-out session. How many sections of an intervention am I going to need? And again, this is an idealistic scenario, but we don't, for our interventions to be effective, the guidelines for secondary schools are to have anywhere from 8 to 12. We've seen intervention periods that are actually, in some cases, larger than the general education classroom. And what that does, well, obviously what that does is it waters down the intensity of the intervention and makes it a lot less effective. Okay. So we want to make sure that to the extent possible, we maintain an appropriate teacher-student ratio. And then we want to think about, you know, do I need multiple intervention types across my grade levels? If that's the case and I'm just getting started and I have limited resources, then I may want to put a priority on reading. And then my next, you know, once I get that down, maybe my next priority would be writing, right? So what we have found in all of our work and what is summarized really nicely by the National Center on RTI is that most secondary schools did not try to solve and schedule for addressing all of their needs at once. They either picked a grade, they picked one step in the process, or they picked a really small focus. And most of the schools fell into that last category. So most of the schools were concerned about reading. And so they started with a system that would allow them to identify kids at risk for reading and then to really think about how to schedule the intervention and supports around improving reading outcomes for their kids. Okay. So once we've determined our student need, then we really need to find some time within different scheduling options to provide intervention. And again, so many things in schools, there's really not a one-size-fits-all when it comes to the logistics of it, right? So what I tried to do is just present as many different options as I have found both in our own work, in the work that's been reported at the National Center, and then work done by the few others who are working on secondary models of RTI intervention. And so some of the things that we found that were consistent from all of those different sources were, you know, some schools would take that who used a block period, they would, you know, steal time from each of their blocks to create what they called skinny periods. And again, to manage the somewhat overwhelming nature of the task for larger schools, a lot of schools when they first got started just created skinny periods for everyone. And then depending on what your benchmark and performance data was indicating, you would either work on enrichment, right? So kids who were well above benchmark, they would have an enrichment time. Kids who are at grade level would have time, like what they call an exploratory time, and kids who needed an intervention would get that more targeted support. We see lots of schools looking at both before and after school time, so creating 0 hours before school, providing after school supports in places where they can get cooperation and agreement from parents. Most schools use the intervention as an elective model. So in a standard 7-period day, where there's or six period, you know, whichever you follow, where there's four or five core classes, and then two electives. Kids who need intervention, one of their electives has to be intervention. And, you know, a common concern in that model is, well, I don't want to take electives away from kids who are struggling, and maybe that's the only avenue in. And people who decided to make the intervention truly an elective over time reverse that decision, and in large part because through their conversations with parents and saying, you know, what do you think is the most important thing for your child, almost always say, I want him or her to have better reading, and so I want them to be an intervention. So almost every school that we've worked with locally that started with making intervention optional moved to, if your performance is here, intervention is not optional for you. Sorry, you'll get your elective back when you, you know, when we help you get back to grade level. We've seen, I worked with a secondary, both middle and high school in Little Rock, Arkansas, that used push-in models for reteaching skills because their school campus was so large that by the time they could find intervention classrooms and then the kids made the trek, and sometimes didn't always find their way to their intervention class, right? They'd end up leaving campus because, again, it was such a big campus that it was just easy for kids to disappear. They found it was way more effective to keep kids in their classes and then to push in teachers, and then just even for kids who needed intense support, they just pulled them in the back. So it was kind of a push-in model, but it was really more of a combination of push-in in terms of that's where the service was delivered, but it really was intensive, and so it was like a pull-out model, if that makes sense. And then we work with a lot of charter schools who have, for a number of reasons, a lot more flexibility in their scheduling, and so we actually have a number of charter schools who have adopted a longer school day, 4 days a week, and then they have their teachers come in Friday for not a full day, but it's a little longer than a half day. And what that does is that provides them all of that time that they need for collaboration. And because the school day is longer on those 4 days, they have that time to provide intervention for kids who need it. So that's not a model that will work for everybody. But it is one that we are seeing more and more often with our public charter schools. Okay. So the next several slides, I just pulled some actual examples of different class schedules. And again, it's not to say that this is the way you should do it. It's really just some examples that might help you think, you know, outside of the box, or help you think a little more creatively, I guess, about how you can look at your own schedule and where you can find those times and periods where you can provide those interventions. And so here's just a middle school example where they built in their exploratory, which is their elective time, and then they freed up time for essential skills, and everybody in the grade got essential skills, but they were one who did, you know, more of that tiered. So if you're an advanced student, you get enrichment. If you're a kid who's below, you get intervention. If you're a kid who's on target, then we continue to further advance your skills. Here's a 90-90 block where schools that have those 90 minutes, they then free up time for intervention for the kids who need it. Kids who don't need that intervention then can have two periods of electives and one period of English. So this is a model that we've actually seen in place. This is how most of the high schools that we end up working with end up structuring their time during that 90 minutes. And so within those 90 minutes of the intervention, a lot of times that 90 minutes is even further divided for kids who need intervention. So it's like 45 minute focus, maybe on remediation, right? On like actually strengthening the skill. And then the second half used on supporting kids in the general class content. Okay. Here's just an example of 0 hour, right? So we have some kids coming in before school, and we have kids who are not enrolled in literacy intervention. They can take an elective for first period. And then another very common class schedule is the 4x4 block, where kids have different courses over the different semesters, right? And so same thing, we have a literacy intervention option for kids who need it. Kids who don't need it take another elective for that block time. Okay. So those are just examples. Again, the National Center for RTI has a couple other examples of schedules. And then they also have a list of the schools that participated in the middle school evaluation study. And so, you know, sometimes it's better to ask those pragmatic questions straight to the administrators who help make them possible. And so there's school site listings so that you can get in touch and ask even more specific questions about the logistics of it all. So we have walked through having our leadership team manage our RTI process. We have made sure that we allocate time for assessment. We have identified our student need and come up with creative solutions for making sure we can structure our day to provide that intervention. But the other consideration, and this one shouldn't necessarily be after, this should be a part of, right, is thinking about the frequency and duration of the intervention. And again, that should be determined by the goals of the intervention and the severity of need of your group. So if you're remediating foundational skill gaps, you're probably better off doing much more frequent but shorter interventions, right? Because a lot of kids who struggle have issues with short-term memory or working memory, and they haven't developed that solid grasp of those foundational skills. The more frequently you are able to expose kids and provide them practice in those skills, the more progress they'll make, right? If you're looking on, if you're concentrating on more learning strategies, so those would be things like organizing assignments and taking notes, you know, those kinds of like study skills and organizational strategies, you might look at a combination of pull-out, right? So pull-out time where I can actually teach the strategy, and push-in, so push-in time where I can actually help the students transfer what I taught them and pull out into the general ed setting, okay? And then another question that's really important, and again, not one that anyone except the school team can really answer, but how fluid is your system going to be? So at the elementary level, it's a little bit easier to be fluid. And by fluid, I mean if a child is placed in intervention and meets their goals after 5 weeks, then, you know, we pull them, we stop sending them to intervention because typically we're not so period and bell driven at the elementary level, right? And so we have that latitude to say, okay, you've met your goals, we're, you know, 5 weeks in or 6 weeks into the semester, and now you just don't go to intervention anymore. At secondary schools, that can cause a problem because we have things like credits and very much more complicated schedules to manage. And so we have found that most secondary models, that's both middle and high school for RTI, really the most fluid they get is a semester-by-semester review of whether a student needs to keep going for intervention. I think I've only read about one school that was really able to create a system, and it's in Minnesota, it's a much smaller school, create more of that elementary dynamic where students could come in and out a lot easier. But most secondary schools do that semester by semester approach. Okay. So we've been focusing on how we organize our schedule for our students, but at the middle school level, it's really important to think about who is going to provide my intervention, because most middle schools don't have the luxury of having a reading specialist or a math specialist on staff. And so, again, best practice and ideal world, we are pairing our best teachers with our hardest to teach students. Right? So we don't want paraprofessionals, unless they're highly trained and well mentored and supervised, to be providing intervention for our struggling students, right? Because they just don't have the training in the background all the time to really meet the needs of what our middle school struggling students are facing. So while we may not have a reading specialist, we really want to work hard to try and get someone who has a good knowledge of reading to run our intervention, right? Even though there are lots of intervention programs, and we'll look at those next week, that are scripted and that are planned, and they're done that way not so that just anyone can pick them up, but they're done that way because they adhere to a set of instructional design principles that, when led by a highly trained, effective teacher, really results in strong growth and outcomes for our struggling students. And so we want to get somebody who has a good background in reading. So some of the ways, usually schools will have someone on staff who has that background. And for schools that haven't, we have seen, and again, you know, I work in Idaho, lots of, except for two of our districts, most of our districts are quite small. But we have seen secondary schools go to their district and then through some really great collaboration, reading specialists are sometimes then moved from the elementary school for a period or two to address concerns in the middle school while they're getting someone else up to speed on reading interventions for the middle school. Okay? And so I focus on reading a lot because, again, that's mostly where schools start. But the same is true for math and writing. So we want someone who's not only, you know, a really good math teacher because they know math well, but who's a really good math intervention teacher. And so we want to be mindful of who that is and then how we make sure we free up time for that person during the day. So this example is just an intervention schedule. And again, it's an ideal scenario where we have intervention folks at the various grade levels. And we're using those titles. It doesn't mean that that the person has the, you know, that certification or credential. It's the person we've designated to be the math interventionist. And then we want to set up our period for that person to make sure that they have planning time, and then when are they going to run different interventions? When are they going to be in more of those push-in settings where they're co-teaching or providing services in the general ed classroom? Where are they going to have to collect data? So on this literacy coach, you'll see the data co-teach, right? So that person's assigned to do progress monitoring and data collection. Okay, so I hope that has at least addressed some of the questions and issues and concerns that some of you might have with, you know, how do you manage all of this implementation stuff? And with that, before we start talking about next time, I think I'll stop and just see, does anybody have any questions or comments? I see a couple of people typing, so we'll just... Oh, you're welcome, Joan. And while Claudia finishes up what she's typing, next session we will focus on Tier 2 interventions. And so if you have specific questions about intervention, it's really helpful for you to post those now or to send them to Molly before we meet next Wednesday. And that way, instead of just, you know, sharing with you what I know about intervention, I just want to make sure that I'm addressing your specific questions. So Claudia is asking, do I have a rough estimate of how many students in math or reading interventions can be handled for a caseload? So I feel like my answer to everything these days is it depends, but it kind of does depend. So again, ideally we keep our intervention teacher to student ratios at that 8 to 12 students to one intervention specialist, and that's because our kids who are struggling need more intensity, and yet. The literature at middle and high school has found that those slightly larger recommendations than what we usually say because usually we say 3 to 5 at elementary, that those slightly larger at the older grades, we don't have always the same attentional issues as our younger kids, but the other thing is there's a little bit more safety, so you're not singled out as a kid who needs intervention. So if we keep those ratios small, then the 8 to 12, then an intervention teacher should really be handling the same kind of caseload as any other teacher. So if in your building you have 7 periods and your teachers teach, 5 and have 2 preps, or teach 6 and have a prep, like the same kind of load should apply to your intervention teachers. So if you're using more of a push-in model, then for those to be effective, you really need to make sure that you have collaboration time, right? Push-in only works if I really know what is happening in the general ed classroom, so that in my support I'm providing to students, I really have the time to think about what that support should be to help them access that general ed content. So I feel like I probably haven't answered your question probably in the way you'd like me to, but it really does depend on what you're asking of your intervention teacher and then what you hope to gain. For teachers who are, if we put kids on caseload and suddenly I've got, 150 struggling kids that I'm responsible for getting to grade level, I don't know if that's going to happen during the day. So that's where we want to, maybe be more strategic about what our intervention looks like. Who else can we pull in? Are there things that we can do that maybe don't require a reading specialist, but that would still get our kids practicing reading with other teaching staff, if that makes sense. Okay. So I see Joan and Claudia typing some more. And then if you have questions, again, if you have questions about interventions for next week, please send those. And with that, I'll wait and see what pops up from Joan and Claudia, and then Molly is putting up the link for the evaluation for this week. Okay, so Joan is, how do we respond to administrators who want recommendations only for program? Oh, that's a great question, Joan, and I have got a really good answer for you. So I hope, I really do. So I hope you will come back next week, and we will take on Joan's very important question about using programs with scientific evidence and then, other evidence. Okay. Great. So thank you all for signing in to these sessions. I hope they're helpful. Thank you, Molly, for hosting and running them. And I will look forward to seeing all of you next week.